Welcome to the Deep Dive. So today, you guys have steered our curiosity towards a topic that, well, I think a lot of us navigate every day, the care that we provide for our animals. And we've got a really fascinating collection of material to dive into. We've got articles charting the evolution of pet care in general, a focused look at centuries of horse husbandry, and then a really rich text that's just filled with historical insights from all different cultures. So, let's unpack this. Our mission today is to kind of journey through this wealth of information, uncover maybe some surprising historical turns, and kind of trace how our approaches to animal care have transformed over time, right? Yeah. Highlighting maybe some of the key shifts in our thinking and practices. And we're aiming to provide, I think, a really comprehensive overview, you know, tailored for you, the listener, who wants to kind of grasp this history pretty quickly and thoroughly, but without feeling, you know, bogged down.
Absolutely. What you've gathered really presents a really interesting picture. And our goal is to kind of connect those dots, revealing those sometimes unexpected ways our relationship with animals and their care have evolved. And we'll be looking at not just the practical aspects, but also, I think, those underlying attitudes that have shaped how we've looked after them from the very earliest times right up to today.
Fantastic. Yeah, we've got a real timeline here stretching from ancient practices all the way to the latest, you know, scientific understanding. So let's just dive right in. I mean, what immediately struck me when looking at these sources is, you know, just the sheer antiquity of our connection with and care for animals. You know, we're talking about roots that go back tens of thousands of years.
Indeed. The evidence for these early bonds is quite compelling. I mean, think about those cave paintings, right? Dating back over 15,000 years. Those depictions of dogs alongside humans in hunting scenes, it suggests a cooperative relationship, a working partnership, and likely a degree of mutual reliance that hints at something, you know, beyond just mere utility.
Right. It really does make you think about the nature of that early relationship. And then, you know, if we jump forward to ancient Egypt, wow, I mean, the level of care and even what looks like, you know, profound reverence for certain animals is, it's quite something. We're seeing evidence of cats being mummified as early as 3000 BCE, complete with these elaborate rituals and dedicated burial sites. That's not just basic upkeep. That speaks to a real significant cultural importance.
What's truly remarkable here, and perhaps a key, you know, early insight into our evolving relationship with animals, is that this wasn't solely about, you know, their practical use. Those elaborate burials, they suggest, you know, a deep emotional connection, perhaps even a spiritual significance that's attributed to these creatures. And the sources also mention specialized collars for both cats and dogs, sometimes even adorned with protective amulets, you know, indicating this real concern for their well-being, for their safety.
That's fascinating. It's almost like they were seen as, I don't know, members of the family. And there's that early tomb painting, right, from around 3500 BCE, showing a man walking his dog on a leash, a scene that feels surprisingly contemporary.
It absolutely bridges the millennia. And the belief in meeting one's dog in the afterlife, I mean, that really underscores the depth of the emotional bond. And then that detail that dogs, unlike cats, were consistently given names inscribed on their collars. That act of naming, it feels so personal. It signifies this distinct individual relationship.
Yeah, it does. It really does. It suggests a level of individual recognition and attachment that you know, and you consider the severe penalties for harming a dog, especially one with a collar, you know, in some instances, including capital punishment. It really highlights their value within that society. The sources even point out that the grief experienced over the death of a family dog was comparable to that felt for a human. That's, I mean, that's a powerful indication of their place in people's lives.
It is. And this high regard for animal, it wasn't, you know, isolated to Egypt. Ancient Persia also held dogs in incredibly high esteem. Apparently, killing a dog was believed to guarantee a place in the House of Lies, their equivalent of, well, hell. That's a pretty serious spiritual consequence tied to animal welfare.
Wow. Yeah. It certainly emphasizes the importance they placed on these animals and this encouragement to care for dogs as one would care for humans, nursing them when injured, providing care for pregnant dogs. It indicates, like, this profound sense of responsibility, even the daily ritual of reserving three morsels of food for one's dog as this gesture of gratitude. It paints a vivid picture of just this, like, deeply integrated relationship.
It's almost humbling to consider that level of respect so long ago. And then, you know, moving beyond companionship, our sources also shed light on the early origins of what we now recognize as veterinary medicine in several ancient civilizations.
Yes. The evidence suggests that practices aimed at addressing animal health existed in China, Mesopotamia, India, and Egypt around 3000 BCE. And that it kind of coincides roughly with those, you know, early Egyptian cat mummies.
And the Kahun papyrus from Egypt, dating to around 1860 BCE, is considered one of the earliest known veterinary texts.
And this Egyptian text is significant because it represents one of the earliest attempts to, you know, systematically record animal ailments and their treatments, offering us this glimpse into early veterinary practices. We even have the first individual known to us by name who specialized in animal health.
Hmm.
Or Lugaldina, a Sumerian physician from around 2121 BCE. Remarkable. It gives a personal connection to these early efforts. Yeah, it really does. And it's interesting to see this kind of specialized knowledge emerging so early in human history. Our sources also point to kind of parallel developments in other parts of the world. In China, around the same period, we hear about horse priests utilizing acupuncture to treat horses. And if we look at ancient Mongolia, there's evidence of both a deep respect for horses and a practical understanding of their physical needs, even noting injuries resulting from bridles and bits.
It really does paint a picture of, you know, a widespread, albeit diverse, awareness of animal well-being in the ancient world. And then those elaborate facilities constructed for horses in both China and Egypt, I mean, that speaks volumes about their practical and symbolic significance in these societies. And the practice among the Berbers of bringing their horses into their tents, I mean, that offers this powerful image of very close relationship, born out of both necessity and a clear respect for the animal.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see these different expressions of the human-animal bond across these cultures. Now, as we move forward in time, we start to see the emergence of kind of more formalized approaches to animal health, particularly in ancient Greece.
Yes, Hippocrates, whom we largely associate with human medicine, also documented early veterinary treatments around 400 BCE, according to our sources.
It's interesting that his insights extended beyond, you know, human health. What were some of the key principles that he applied to animals?
Crucially, Hippocrates emphasized the role of environmental factors, diet, and lifestyle in maintaining health, whether in humans or in animals. This holistic perspective was quite forward-thinking for the time. And later, around 130 BCE, Metrodorus of Lamia built upon Hippocrates' work, gaining recognition for his skill in healing animals, particularly horses. He was well-regarded as a veterinary surgeon.
So these early medical understandings seem to have been applied pretty broadly. And then we have Plato's interesting view of dogs as philosophers, recognizing their friends through knowledge. That's a unique perspective on animal intelligence.
It truly is. It offers a glimpse into how ancient thinkers perceive the cognitive abilities of animals. And in ancient India, we see a particularly impressive level of integration between the care of humans and animals. Physicians were often trained in both disciplines, and medical treatises like the Charaka Samhita, Sushruta Samhita, and Harita Samhita included information pertaining to animal health.
And then there's Shalihotra, around the 3rd century BCE, who is considered the first known veterinarian, the father of Indian veterinary sciences. He even authored the Shalihotra Samhita, a comprehensive text dedicated to animal care.
Exactly. And based on his extensive work, the first known veterinary hospital in the world was established in India under the reign of King Ashoka around the same 3rd century BCE, a truly significant landmark in the history of animal welfare and professional veterinary practice.
It's incredible to think about a dedicated animal hospital existing that far back. Meanwhile, in ancient Rome, it seems that the approach to animal care largely built upon the foundations laid by the Greeks, didn't it?
Yes, they adopted and adapted many Greek medical practices. And the work of Galen is particularly noteworthy because he recognized fundamental similarities in the physiology of humans and animals. He even used animal anatomy as a tool to further his understanding of human treatment, highlighting an early comparative approach to medicine.
And then we have Vegetius, whose guide to veterinary medicine became a standard reference for centuries. Amazing how these early writings shaped our understanding for so long.
It is, but as we transition into the medieval period in Europe, our sources suggest a somewhat different trajectory, at least in terms of formalized animal care.
Yeah, it seems like there was a notable decline in much of the previously established veterinary knowledge after the fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, the prevailing views of the church at the time, the theological debates around animals and whether they possessed, you know, immortal souls, well, it led to a diminished interest in their medical well-being.
That's a crucial point. Some historical accounts suggest that the church even actively discouraged dissection and the study of animal anatomy, which would have certainly hindered the advancement and preservation of veterinary knowledge. The focus it shifted away from a scientific understanding of animal health.
Yeah. Sobering to consider how dominant ideologies can influence even something like the care we provide to animals. However, it wasn't a complete loss of knowledge, was it?
Thankfully, no. Our sources indicate that Arab scholars in Spain maintained an interest in equine diseases, likely due to the importance of horses in their culture and military practices. So some of that ancient wisdom was preserved and continued to be developed in that region. And later, in the late 12th and early 13th centuries, we see this renewed interest in animal health within Europe, largely driven by the economic significance of horses for warfare and transportation, and of cattle for agriculture.
So the primary motivation for this renewed interest was still largely utilitarian rather than, you know, an inherent concern for the animals themselves?
Precisely. That concept of caring for an animal purely for its own sake or out of a deep sense of compassion, well, that wouldn't really gain prominence until much later. And it's quite a contrast when we look at what was happening in indigenous cultures in North America with the introduction of horses.
Right. Yeah, that's a fascinating juxtaposition. So for many Native American tribes, like the Comanche and Lakota, the arrival of horses was, well, transformative, wasn't it?
Absolutely. They developed incredibly sophisticated horsemanship skills and integrated horses deeply into their societies. But beyond those practical uses, right, for hunting, warfare, and transportation, many indigenous cultures viewed horses as spiritual beings, deserving of profound respect.
And this relationship fundamentally reshaped their entire way of life.
Indeed. Their traditional knowledge included specialized uses of plant medicines and unique healing practices, specifically for horses. And furthermore, ceremonial practices often honored these animals, reflecting a deep cultural and spiritual connection that went far beyond simple utility.
It really underscores the diverse and multifaceted ways humans have interacted with and cared for animals across, you know, different societies and throughout history. So now let's move forward again to the Industrial Revolution, you know, a period of just immense societal change. How did this era impact the care of both pets and, you know, working animals?
The Industrial Revolution brought about significant and often complex changes. On one hand, we see the emergence of the first commercially produced pet food in 1860, developed by James Spratt, marking a significant shift towards more standardized and convenient feeding practices for companion animals.
And the rise of dog shows in England in the 1850s, that must have also contributed to a more formalized kind of understanding of different breeds and their specific care needs.
It did, leading to the establishment of breed standards and an increased focus on selective breeding for particular traits. We also see the beginnings of pet insurance in Sweden in 1890, reflecting a growing recognition of the financial investment and emotional value associated with pets. And even rudimentary forms of flea control, like pyrethrum-based powders, became commercially available.
So the foundational elements of the modern pet care industry were starting to take shape. But what about the animals that were doing the heavy lifting during this period, like horses? The Industrial Revolution must have presented some significant challenges for them.
It was a particularly demanding time for working horses. Those employed in mines, factories, you know, in these rapidly expanding urban environments, often faced grueling conditions. And this harsh reality led to the formation of those earliest animal welfare organizations specifically dedicated to horses, advocating for improved treatment and working conditions. So while veterinary understanding was advancing, the practical realities for many working animals remained quite difficult.
Yeah, it's a stark reminder that technological progress doesn't always equate to improved welfare for all beings. But, you know, as mechanization began to replace horses in many roles, their primary function, it shifted, didn't it?
Yes, horses increasingly transitioned into roles in, you know, recreation and sport. And this shift in their purpose also led to breeding practices that emphasized specialized performance traits.
Now, alongside this industrial transformation, the Age of Enlightenment played a vital role in the resurgence and evolution of veterinary medicine as a formal discipline, correct?
Absolutely. There was a significant revival of serious scholarly interest in veterinary medicine across Europe during the Enlightenment. Interestingly, as our sources point out, this renewed interest largely overlooked the earlier contributions from non-European cultures that we discussed earlier. The prevailing view at the time was that the classical Greek and Roman texts represented the earliest foundations of the field.
So figures like Hippocrates, Galen, and Vegetius, they became the primary points of reference for the development of modern veterinary science in Europe. And this intellectual climate, it led to a pivotal moment. The founding of the first dedicated veterinary educational institution in Europe, in France, in 1762, by Claude Bourgelat.
Exactly. This landmark event was largely in response to a, you know, devastating cattle plague,
Highlighting
that direct link between animal health and human well-being and the need for specialized knowledge. The subsequent establishment of the Royal Veterinary School in France and similar institutions across Europe and the United States, you know, marked this crucial turning point towards a more scientific and formalized approach to the study and practice of animal medicine. The first such institution in the U.S. was founded in Philadelphia in 1852.
And while Bourgelat is often credited as the father of veterinary medicine, it's important to remember, as our sources remind us, that this title doesn't fully acknowledge those significant and earlier contributions from other cultures, such as the veterinary practices documented in the Kahun Papyrus in Egypt, and that established veterinary tradition in India, you know, under figures like Shalihotra and the subsequent establishment of animal hospitals. It's a valuable reminder to maintain that broader historical perspective.
It is indeed. And as we move into the 20th and 21st centuries, the rate of change in how we care for our animals, it accelerates dramatically.
Yeah, it certainly does. The mid-20th century saw the introduction of commercial dry pet food manufacturing in the 1950s, a real watershed moment in how we feed our companion animals, offering convenience and widespread availability. We also saw the emergence of early synthetic flea collars in the 1960s, although we now know that some of the pesticides that they contained were quite harmful by today's standards.
That's right. The 1960s also witnessed that standardization and widespread implementation of pet vaccination protocols, which had this profound impact on preventing and controlling infectious diseases in our companion animals. However, animal training methods during this period were still largely based on dominance theory and often employed correction-based techniques. And for horses, mechanization continued its advance, leading to a decline in overall populations, but an increased focus on performance and specialized breeding, with modern pharmaceutical interventions increasingly replacing those traditional herbal remedies.
It sounds like a period characterized by, you know, some significant advancements alongside some approaches that, well, we now recognize as less than optimal in terms of animal well-being. But the late 20th century, however, brought about some important shifts in perspective, didn't it?
It did. We saw the development and introduction of specialized veterinary diets in the 1980s, designed to address specific health conditions in pets. And perhaps more significantly, in terms of understanding animal welfare, positive reinforcement training methods began to gain considerable traction, largely thanks to the work of pioneers like Karen Pryor.
That shift towards, you know, understanding animal behavior and utilizing these positive reward-based methods, that seems like a really crucial step forward in promoting animal welfare and strengthening that human-animal bond.
It was indeed. And around the same time, the scientific study of the human-animal bond began to flourish, providing empirical evidence of the numerous health benefits, both physical and psychological, that these relationships provide to humans. We also saw the introduction of microchipping technology for pets in the early 1990s, which has proven to be this invaluable tool for reuniting lost animals with their families. And for horses, research began to challenge many long-held traditional management practices, with this growing recognition that practices like social isolation and constant confinement were contrary to their natural social and behavioral needs.
Yeah. It's remarkable how our understanding of animal behavior and their, you know, inherent needs has evolved and begun to directly influence our care practices.
Absolutely. And early ethological studies of horses revealed the complexity of their social structures and their rich emotional lives, leading to this greater awareness of the potential negative impacts of domestication alongside its benefits.
And that brings us to the early 21st century and the present day, where the field of animal care continues to evolve, I mean, at a rapid pace.
Indeed. The market for pet supplements has grown into a multi-billion dollar industry. We've seen the rise of the connected pet through technologies like GPS collars and remote pet cameras. And there's been a resurgence in the popularity of raw feeding and ancestral diets for pets, reflecting this desire among some owners to return to more natural feeding approaches. And we now have access to, you know, incredibly sophisticated diagnostic tools and highly specialized surgical procedures for our companion animals.
It's almost overwhelming to consider the sheer breadth of options and information available today. And what are some of the kind of defining characteristics of our current approaches to caring for both our pets and horses?
In both pet and horse care, we're seeing a much greater emphasis on integrating behavioral science and this profound recognition of their emotional and cognitive needs, you know, moving beyond just basic physical provision. There's this growing trend towards incorporating natural remedies and holistic approaches, ideally grounded in evidence-based research, Personalized care plans tailored to the individual animal are becoming increasingly common. And for horses specifically, there's this significant movement towards integrating traditional horsemanship wisdom with the latest scientific findings, acknowledging them as sentient beings with complex social and emotional requirements. We're seeing this reevaluation of what constitutes natural horse management, often drawing insights from the behavior of wild horse populations, and this shift towards more partnership-based interactions rather than purely dominance-focused methods.
So it sounds like we're moving towards a more holistic and nuanced kind of understanding of the animals in our lives, recognizing their individuality and their intricate needs.
Exactly. And there's this growing ethical awareness surrounding that balance between utilizing animals for human purposes and ensuring their overall well-being. And alongside this are increasing efforts dedicated to the preservation of rare breeds and maintaining genetic diversity within animal populations.
It has been an absolutely incredible journey to kind of trace this evolution of animal care from, you know, ancient expressions of reverence and those fundamental provisions to today's, you know, much more scientifically informed and emotionally attuned practices.
It has. And the persistent threads of the human-animal bond and our ever-deepening understanding of animal needs are really striking across all these diverse cultures and historical periods.
So as we conclude this deep dive, you know, it leaves me, and hopefully you, our listener, with this final thought. Considering this long and fascinating history, what might the next major evolution in our understanding and care of animals look like? What new ethical considerations or scientific breakthroughs might shape the future of our relationships with, you know, the animals who share our lives? It's certainly something to ponder. Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive.
Viva la Podcast. Podcasten muss sich wieder lohnen.
Wir bieten dir kostenloses Podcast-Hosting ohne Limitierungen.
Du kümmerst dich ums Podcasten.
Und wir kümmern uns um den Rest.
Und das Beste daran, du verdienst auch noch Geld ab dem ersten Hörer.
Der ersten Hörerin. Besuche uns auf kostenlos-hosten.de und informiere dich.
Teure Hostingkosten müssen nicht sein. Kostenlos-hosten.de. Die Podcast-Re-Evolution.
Dir hat dieser Podcast gefallen? Dann klicke jetzt auf Abonnieren und empfehle ihn weiter. Bleib immer auf dem Laufenden und folge uns bei Twitter, Instagram und Facebook. Mehr Podcasts findest du auf meinpodcast.de.
Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.